I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. A lively look at the contemporary art market is had in the new book, The Orange Balloon Dog, Bubbles, Turmoil, and Avarice in the Contemporary Art Market. Its author, Don Thompson, joins me now, and I'll get him to tell us about how the prices in today's marketplace are driven by political and behavior-based economics. In the book, he looks at the mood of buyers and sellers, just who these people are, and the volatility of the international market. Don Thompson is an economist and emeritus Nabisco Brands Professor of Marketing and Strategy of the Schulich School of Business at York University. He has degrees from the University of California, Berkeley, and has taught at Harvard Business School and the London School of Economics. He has written 12 books, including the best-selling The $12 Million Stuff Shark and The Supermodel in the Brillo Box, Backstories and Peculiar Economics from the World of Contemporary Art. This new book is published by Douglas and McIntyre. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program in Toronto today, Don Thompson. Professor Thompson, good morning.
Good morning.
Don, this is such a good book, as I was telling you just before we started. You have written books about art and the art world, if you will, the business side of it before, right?
Yes. Yeah, this is art market book three.
Yeah. And so, I mean, does the market itself change year after year? I mean, I'm sure it does, but I mean, if we take, say, where prices are when it comes to modern or contemporary art today as opposed to, say, 25, 50 years ago, I mean, there's been a great inflation, hasn't there?
Yeah, it's hard to compare that far back because what you had then was still 19th century art, early 20th century art, impressionist art, and contemporary art, that done after 1970, has greatly surpassed what was sold 50 years ago because most of the 50-year-old art, most impressionist art, for example, is in museums and collections, and it just doesn't appear at auction anymore.
Yeah. But have the values of, say, a group of seven paintings, I mean, those have gone up in value over the last 100 years, right? 75 years at least.
They have gone up, but group of seven paintings have a market that is 95% Canadian.
Mm-hmm.
There are probably only 200 artists in the world who have much of a market outside of their home country. So Canadian artists are sold in Canada. Swedish art is purchased in Sweden and so on. And there are very, very few Canadian artists who have much of a market outside of Canada. And curiously, there's not much of a market for a group of seven work outside of Canada.
Hmm, interesting. Don, the orange balloon dog that you refer to in the title of your book,
yes.
would you tell us about that? Because, I mean, it's a great way to get us into this the marketplace. And what sort of art we're really talking about?
Well, the orange balloon dog is interesting because it sold a couple of years ago at Christie's Auction House in New York for $58.5 million. Now, that was by 50% higher than any piece of art by a living artist had ever sold for. The previous record was $35 million for Gerhard Richter, who was a contemporary German artist. Now, the balloon dog is 10 feet tall. It's chromium-plated stainless steel. It is an addition to five. It is a reproduction of what a clown makes for a child's birthday party.
Right.
It was, interestingly enough, it was purchased. The book is a lot about behavioral economics and what drives people to do what they do and bid what they bid. This was sold by Christie's pretty much purely on the backstory that it was an edition of five, and the owners of the other four versions of Balloon Dog were four of the most distinguished collectors in the world. Eli Broad in Los Angeles, Stephen Cohen, Connecticut, Dr. Janu in Athens, and François Pinault in Paris, who owns Christie's. And he said, you can join this exclusive club by purchasing the fifth edition of Balloon Dog.
Yeah.
And that, it turns out the entry fee for that exclusive club was $54.5 million.
Yeah. So I mean, in terms of what it looks like, and I mean, what do art critics say about this particular piece?
Well, it's a perfect reproduction of Balloon Dog. It's actually fascinating. I've seen it.
Yeah.
I've seen a couple of them. There's the five of them come in different colors. It's chromium-plated stainless steel. It's reflective. So as you walk around it, you both see yourself and you see the surroundings change. And if you had a really large yard to display it in, it's incredibly striking. Now, the interesting part of it, it was not purchased for status. It was purchased by a New York family called McGrabby, who said they had purchased it as an investment, and they resell it in 5 years for $100 million. Now, 5 years is next year, and we'll see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
The improbability of that, you know, it reflects on, is art a good investment? Is art a good store of wealth? Given that it's probably costing McGrabby's 15% a year to store it and maintain it and insure it. So, we'll see next year what happens.
Yeah. So the buyers of art, I mean, they have changed, certainly. I mean, are we talking about, say, nouveau riche buying art for status, or, as you said a moment ago, that to get into an exclusive club of people that own the stuff already?
30 years ago, 40 years ago, art was purchased primarily by families with inherited wealth. It was essentially something the collecting gene was inherited. The idea of having great art on the wall was inherited. Today, 90% of the market are newly created millionaires and billionaires, largely from the financial world. Actually, curiously, not so much from IT. Mm. There's very little collecting activity in Silicon Valley and San Francisco from IT. But from the financial world and other sources. And, of course, the collecting market's gone international.
Yeah.
Western art is now collected in China and Japan. Malaysia is a major center. Korea is, and Russia. So it is a world market. And most of the people who collect now do not come from families where collecting was any kind of priority.
Yeah. And so as a result, because the prices are so high, is the overheated market for art, is that inflated? And I mean, like real estate, say, as we're talking about in this country, I mean, is it part of a bubble that'll burst soon?
Well, the book is about, there are several art markets, and the book is about that really fascinating area of which is probably the top 100th of 1%. Think of art that sells at auction over $5 million.
Mm-hmm.
And consider that only one Canadian artwork has ever sold above that. Interestingly enough, going back to Bloom Dog, which sold for $58.5 million, that is virtually the size of the entire Canadian art market for a year.
Mm.
Auctions, dealer sales, private sales, one piece. So we're looking at the top, very, very top slice of the market, and prices there have gone wild. And it probably is a bubble. For a $10 million work, there are probably 100 buyers in the world. Christie says 100, Sotheby says 150. And if their tastes change, if collecting contemporary art goes out of fashion and collecting antique autos comes in,
yeah,
then that market gets pretty thin.
Did you find that with the economic crisis of, say, 9 years ago, did interest in contemporary art, did that fall?
Well, prices fell.
Mm.
But interestingly, prices at the top of the market fell 10 to 20%. Prices in the next third of the market fell about 30%. And prices sort of in 50% below that. And I'm talking about art sold at auction. Fell 50%. So the better the art, the better they held their prices. But billionaires were still billionaires, but they struck pretty good bargains.
Yeah.
When buying.
Yeah. So if a piece gets millions and millions of dollars, how much of that does the artist get, say?
None.
Hmm.
Now, there's a European Union, there's an artist's rights provision that for work sold at auction, pretty much only, the artist gets a very small percentage of the selling price. But that's not true in North America. In general, the artist gets nothing.
Yeah.
Except that their primary work sold to a dealer is now seen to be worth more, because the dealer can say, look, this sold for $1 million at auction.
So who makes the money then? I guess it's people like Christie's and Sotheby's, right?
Well, they take a percentage, and the buyer, maybe a speculator, maybe a collector, who holds the art for a while and resells it, makes the profit. You know, it's a lot like trading houses in Vancouver. The original builder doesn't get anything.
So what does this say then, or what do, say, emerging or mid-level artists, what do they say about all of this?
Well, it has many effects, and one of the kind of sad effects is it's drawn a huge number of new people to art school thinking, you know, I've seen Damien Hirst's work, he paints spot paintings, he gets $3 million for them, I can do that. And it was a little like Warhol, you know, did lithographic prints of Marilyn Monroe, mm-hmm. and colored them and sold them for high prices. And now they're sold for millions of dollars in the market. And art students say, I can do that. But only the originator really benefits from it. What has happened is that a lot more people collect contemporary art, a higher percentage of people do today than did 10 years ago or 20 years ago. So there's a wider market for middle-level art and entry-level level art. So I guess in that way, artists have benefited.
Yeah. It is misleading, though, isn't it, when you read in the paper that a balloon dog can get tens of millions of dollars, and you think, well, yeah, maybe I could do that on the weekend. You know?
Jeff Koons' balloon dog is a spectacularly engineered piece of art. It is seamless.
Yeah.
It really is. If any of your listeners ever get a chance to see one, it really is worth seeing. It is quite spectacular. And no, you and I couldn't do it.
So you mentioned about seeing art, and you talk in the book. There's a great portion of the book that you talk about the places where art is displayed, museums. And the different kinds of museums and how that's being used by their donors, the proprietors, for financial purposes as well as say, just a repository where people can go and view this stuff.
Yeah, there's a strong trend, particularly in the U.S., to collectors, instead of giving their art to a museum, they simply build their own museum. Now, one of the benefits to that is most good museums will not take your donation and promise to display it. They'll take it, and you might have a provision that says that, you know, it has to be shown for 3 months every 10 years. But otherwise, the walls would fill up with donated art, and there'd be no need for a curator. So you can donate 100 works to a museum, and only five of them will be on show at any given time. If you build your own museum, first of all, you create a foundation. You give money to the foundation, and you get a tax deduction. Foundation builds a museum. Then you give the art to the foundation, and you get a deduction. But you're the curator. You're the director. So all of the art is shown all of the time, and all of the maintenance costs for the foundation, for the museum, are tax write-offs. And there are now a lot of those in the U.S. and more coming. The Broad Foundation in Los Angeles is one your listeners may be familiar with. And Eli Broad put probably $400 million into building it and gave it and endowed it with $200 million plus about 2,000 works of art. It's quite spectacular. But it reflects one person's collecting preferences. It does not reflect the taste of a set of curators or a director. It reflects one person's taste. That's interesting, but it's different than a conventional museum.
Yeah. Yeah, you take the Getty, for example. It's a great tourist attraction. I guess it's free, isn't it?
The Getty in Los Angeles is nominally free, although you have to pay to get there. So you have to take a cable car up to it.
Yeah, so I mean, you're seeing that a lot, too, in terms of museums. I'm trying to remember, I think it was in Dallas, was it? The museum there where they decided to do away with admission.
Yes, that has not spread much. But there is, Dallas discovered that, of course, the Dallas Museum was reaching only one portion of the population.
Yeah.
So whole neighborhoods, whole parts of the city, and whole racial groups that weren't being reached because it was expensive. And so the director, who was very innovative, figured out that if you charged no admission and just made it a meeting place for people and bussed people in, for that matter, you could probably raise in donations more than you lost in admissions income because you were now essentially delivering culture to a whole part of the population that hadn't been exposed to it before. Now, how well that would work in different cities, we don't know, but it's a wonderful idea.
Yeah, and then little sort of gimmicks in terms of the QR code next to the painting, and if you scan that with your phone, you would get points, and that would go towards parking. I mean, I don't know if that's the Dallas Museum, but that's certainly one that you talk about in the book, right?
That's the Dallas Museum.
Yeah.
One of the purpose, though, secondary purchase is very useful purpose, and that is, what do people like? Traditional curators tend to show traditional art. The truth is that in most North American museums, people want to see contemporary art. And we're probably moving to a position now where instead of showing traditional art and having special shows of contemporary art, museums will show contemporary art and have special shows of historical art. Because contemporary art is what most people want to go and see.
Yeah. There was a story in the book that you tell about how the wealthy use art to dodge taxes. And a number of stories in terms of that. But the one in particular that I found interesting was the one where, and I can't remember who it was now, bought the piece of art and then shipped it out of state to avoid taxes?
Yeah, this is just a U.S. phenomenon. This was a $100 million plus work of art.
Yeah.
And it was purchased on auction in New York. And you would have had to pay New York State sales tax of 13%, which on $100 billion is a lot of money.
Yeah.
However, if it's shipped out of New York State, you don't have to pay sales tax. However, most states also have what's called a use tax, and that's to prevent you from buying in another state and shipping it in. So if this particular buyer who lives in Los Angeles had shipped it to California, she would have had to have paid a 13% use tax. However, if she ships it to Oregon and shows it in an Oregon museum for, I think, 30 weeks, Oregon has no use tax, and it's then considered to have been used, and you can import it free into California. So by shipping it to Oregon and showing it the work for, I think, 30 weeks in Portland, Oregon, she saved upwards of $13 million.
That's why when I see the flyer here in Vancouver about just how great the museums are in Oregon, I guess that's why, right?
This particular museum, I don't know you'd call it great. It's certainly not a top 50 museum. But it has had a lot of interesting shows of people doing just what was what you mentioned. And, you know, where artists essentially are transported through there for a period of weeks to be shown before it's taken home.
Yeah. And it's sold to us, I guess, in terms of marketing, just how a great art city it is, and I suppose that's happening a lot. What do you like looking at yourself, Don, in terms of art?
Well, I like contemporary art, and I like it a lot more than I did when I started writing about the art market.
Yeah.
Interestingly, your tastes do expand, and I guess I'm certainly not an artist. I'm not an art critic, and I guess like most listeners, I would say I know what I like, but I like a broader range of contemporary art than I did before, and it's interesting just to go to a show and see what do you like, what touches your soul, what would you like to steal and take home, and why? Why do I like it? And what really don't I like? And then try and figure out why you don't like it, which is just as interesting.
Yeah. And then so there's no connection between, say, taste and value, is there?
No. The worth of a piece and its value in art, in the art world, are completely different. The traditional measure, the old museums like the Metropolitan in New York, for most of its existence, weren't allowed to acquire a work of art until 40 years after it was created. Because they said you can't know the value of a work historically until 40 years. And that's a good test. You say, what will this work be valued at in 40 years? That's its worth. And what does it sell for? That's its price. That's its price. And they're different.
This is such a great book. I could talk all afternoon with you, Don. Congratulations on this, and good luck with it. I hope it does well for you, because it's a fascinating, not only a fascinating market to look at, but I mean just to look at the people involved and what's going through their minds. It's fascinating. Thanks for your time today, Don.
Thanks for your interest.
The book is called The Orange Balloon Dog, Bubbles, Turmoil, and Avarice in the Contemporary Art Market. It's published by Douglas & McIntyre. Its author, Don Thompson, joined me on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.